international loan finance. We're looking at the nature, structure and operation of the international lending market. I have provided our draft chapter on the system, which goes through all of this in detail. We will just be highlighting a number of the core points which arise in all of these areas. I've also provided a separate set of tables and diagrams which outline all of this in our visual form so that we can understand all of the key points and key issues which arise. This is a basic, typical Euroloan structure deal with all of the key legal points and issues which arise. This is a simple representation of the difference between a typical Euroloan deal and a Eurobond deal. All we'll simply see is this. There's a large number of additional parties in the bond markets, which means because we have an additional set of relations for each set of parties, we have to have additional documents. So for every party combination, bilateral relationship, we have to have additional documents. We can then reduce all of the key legal terms and conditions in the loan area to one single loan agreement. This might be 100 pages, it might be 200 pages. The difficulty is in the capital market area, we then spread equivalent provisions over a large number of documents. These tend to be simpler, shorter, but there's simply more of them because there's more parties. I've also provided a separate outline with regards to timing of typical international financing structures, in particular with regards to the capital market deals, but we're going to focus more particularly, more specifically on a typical loan deal, and all of this is again covered in the chapter that we have provided. What do we have? We're going to have a lead bank, an arranging bank, who's going to take responsibility for putting the facility together. We're going to have the borrower and the borrower's group. Because these involve very large amounts of money, rarely are we going to lend to one borrower on its own, so it will very often be the borrower and the borrower's group. So for example, we may have one borrower with 9 subsidiaries, so there's 10 borrowers or obligors as well as guarantors. Against that, as we've said already, we'll have a syndicate of banks. So in a typical example, $100 million, we could have one parent bank, 9 subsidiaries, one parent borrower, one parent company, 9 subsidiaries, so that's 10 borrowers drawing down under a single loan facility from 10 banks, each providing $10 million each. We have an arranging bank, the lead bank, that puts the syndicate together. We have the 10 lending banks as part of the syndicate. We'll also then have an agent bank, which is going to administer the syndicate once the funds are being made available and drawn down under the loan arrangement. And we can represent all of that on this table here. One important point to stress is this. We have a single loan agreement. However, in practice, each drawdown becomes a separate obligation. So we can have 10 borrowers with 10 banks, each lending, each drawdown becomes a separate debt. The loan itself isn't, the agreement isn't the loan agreement, that's only a facility which provides the lending which is going to be made available and drawn down. The actual debts themselves, the loans themselves, are entered into on each drawdown, which specifically in the language of the documentation that we're looking at is referred to as a utilization request. So each time one of the companies or one of the subsidiary companies draws down, that becomes the loan. It's not the loan agreement. We will then have a single loan agreement which will set out the terms and conditions for all of the separate legal documentation that we're entering into, although each one of these sub-loans are effectively independent loans, as distinct from the loan agreement itself, which only establishes the larger terms and conditions under which these facilities are made available. In practice then, and I've tried to represent this bottom left on this table, if we have 10 companies and 10 banks, we will then typically have two facilities. We'll have a term loan for a fixed specific duration, and then we'll also have a revolving facility. So we'll have an A, which is fixed, a term loan, and then B, a revolver. You draw down under the fixed facility, you then repay, but you cannot draw down again. Now this may last in our example for up to 20 years. With the revolvers, you draw down, you'll repay after an agreed interest period, for example, repayment period, for example, 6 months or 3 months, 4 months. You can then draw down again, and then you'll repay at the end of that repayment period, and then you can draw down again. So we're combining both a fixed term loan, which is non-repayable, and a revolving facility. In terms of the actual number of loans then, what we can do is begin to multiply this through. If we have at least 10 borrowers, and there's an availability period which determines the time during which they can draw down the facility A, for example, 2 years. And if the borrowers can draw down once a month over 2 years, that's 24. So 24 times 10 is 240 minimum Term A loans. If we then consider that separately in terms of each of the bank's debt obligations, and this is specified in the documentation we're going to look at, we will see specifically in the Loan Market Association, LMA, which is the principal trade association in the loan area, it has a standard multi-currency term loan and revolving facility agreement. Under that agreement in section 2.1, what we will see is this. Each of the obligations of the banks is also specified to be independent and separate. So even though there's a single utilization request which creates a minimum of 240 separate loans in this case, if we also then take in section 2.1, and each of these loans is legally to be classified as being separate and independent, we multiply that by another 10. So we've effectively created 2,400 loan obligations just under the Facility A agreement alone. So although there's a single loan agreement which provides all of this facility and sets out the terms and conditions under which all of this will be made available, in practice we can have up to 2,400 separate facilities, loans under obligations under the Facility A loan. Under the Facility B, if we then make that available for not 2 years, but for the whole of the 20 years, with each borrower being able to draw down each month, that then becomes 24,000 Facility Bs. So if we add 24,000 Facility Bs and 2,400, that becomes 26,400 possible separate loan obligations created under this single facility. There are other limits, however. You will very often specify a limit clause on the total number of loans outstanding at any time. You can have what we call divisibility and consolidation. So we can divide loans and we can also consolidate loans where they're repayable in the same currency at the same time. So in practice, you just need to watch these limits as well. You need to watch the figures which will apply with regards to total limit numbers, as well as any exercise which has been triggered in connection with divisibility and consolidation. The key point to stress again, nevertheless, is that although we have one loan agreement, we'll have multiple separate loans provided and undertaken, entered into under that. What we then do then in the rest of the chapter is expand on all of this. We can see how these term loans and the basic structure of the facilities that were created, these can be used in a large, wide number of other areas and in particular use in applications. We can see these specifically applied in the euro loan area, for multi-purpose and multi-currency loans, for term and revolving facilities, for credit lines, title finance, project finance, property finance, acquisition finance, asset-backed finance and securitization, and subordinated debt. It's the same basic structure, the same basic set of relationships, which is created with the same rights and entitlements and obligations. We reuse that again and again and again in a large number of specific types of facilities in the banking and credit area. What's actually contained then in these documents? We have the core financial provisions. We'll see this on point three here. Principal, term, interest, repayment, prepayment, drawdown and repayment, and then the obligations. The obligations we then expand. We explain those in terms of the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the covenants, and then we have the default clauses. In all of these documents, in all of these facilities, we will have these three specific sets of provisions, and we need to confirm these every time. even if we have a very large, complex, difficult facility, which extends into the hundreds, if not thousands, or tens of thousands of pages, we can always understand the basic core of the document and the core of the relationship and the facility created just by looking at these key provisions. You go straight to the financials, the obligations and the defaults, and very quickly you can form a very strong opinion as to the terms and conditions, quality, validity, and use and application of any particular facility. All of the other additional points which then arise in a typical facility transaction and then expand in the paper. So we can look at issue procedure, we take the mandate letter, key documents, mandate letter, term sheet, information memorandum, the issue procedure itself, I break down to around 12 points, and then you'll exchange fee letters. All of that is to enter into a loan agreement. The typical loan agreement that we will consider specifically is 100 pages, but what we can do is reduce that to one page, front and back, so we can understand all of the key provisions. In terms of the relationship between the banks in the syndicate, these are several. We can explain them in terms of these core provisions, these core principles. The obligations, the liability is several, it's not joint and several. They are liable in proportion to the stated commitment in the schedule, usually schedule one to the document. They don't have to be equal, they could be unequal, simply because there's 10 banks, they don't all have to be providing 1/10 each. Equality, all of the banks, because they're dealing as principal and they're professional wholesale institutions operating in large international markets, everything is dealt with on an equal basis. There is some democracy, but only limited democracy, where there is any form of voting, it tends to be on a qualified majority basis, which is 66 2/3 rather than a simple 50% majority. And then because of that, the corresponding effect is that we have very limited delegation of function, and this corresponds with the scope of the role and duties of the agent bank. So we can then summarise the agent bank duties in terms of receipt duties, payment duties, banking duties, notification duties and default duties. So we can understand the syndicate and the syndicate relationship and structure in terms of these five key ideas: severality, proportionality, equality, democracy and limited delegation. And then that corresponds with the role and function, primary duties of the agent bank, which are receipt, payment, banking and notification duties. We'll then come on and look at issues of liability separately. I summarise it in the paper. This is very important simply because if the borrower and borrowers default, how can the syndicate banks recover? They can't recover from each other because they do not owe each other any duty of care of any form. They haven't entered into separate contractual obligations with regards to each other, and their liabilities are several under the documentation, as we have referred to and as we will see in further detail. Therefore, who can they sue? They can only sue the agent bank or the arranging bank. So we need to consider the scope of their duty and liability, and then how we can control and manage that liability in practice. We'll then look in further detail at the loan obligations, the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties and the covenants. We'll then summarise all of the key default provisions, default remedies, and then we will move on and look at this issue of loan transfers. Loans are inherently non-transferable, and historically you could not transfer a loan. It was a personal debt obligation between two parties. In practice, they then developed forms of assignment, which were then codified in the form of legal assignment under the Law of Property Act, Section 136, Law of Property Act 1925, Section 136. For legal assignment, it has to be for an unconditional amount, it has to be in writing, and you have to give notice. What we will see in practice is that banks do not want to give notice to the borrowers that they are transferring their commitment, effectively their relationship, because they want to keep protect their reputation and the relationship with their customers. So very often they will rely on equitable assignment. The limitation with an equitable assignment is that you can lose priority if there's a separate assignment and the other assignee gives notice to the debtor before you. So even though you were the original assignee, if somebody else gives notice before you give notice, and very often you will not give, intend to give any notice, you can lose priority. And then we'll also look at issues of loan restructuring. we can either have this on a voluntary or a more formalized basis. There's two separate clubs, one called the London Club and the Paris Club, which deal with international loan restructuring. The key point is simply that banks will always want to try to renegotiate where possible, simply because if they put the borrowers into default, they will not receive anything. It's always more desirable to try to renegotiate some form of alternative repayment term, repayment schedule. The most common adjustments will be in terms of the duration and the interest rates. So very often banks will be more than agreeable and acceptable to extend the term, the duration, and to lower the interest periods, but they will be very reluctant to cancel the repayment outright. Very often when borrowers are in difficulty, they're going to want outright cancellation. They want cancellation of the debt by a certain proportion. In practice, that will not be desirable to the banks. However, what tends to happen is that when you have international restructurings, if the lending is to an international financial institution or a government, they will insist on full repayment of principal. They will very rarely relax that. However, when you're dealing with private banks and private lending, they can adjust the repayment. And we saw that, for example, in the international negotiations that surrounded the Greek debt bailout after the European financial crisis, which followed the global financial crisis. There was a substantial haircut agreed on the private bank debt, but not on the institutional and sovereign debt. We will then see we have the Paris Club and the London Club. The Paris Club tends to be government-to-government lending. The London Club is private bank-to-government lending. There's also other mechanisms which are available under the International Monetary Fund and World Bank rules, specifically with regards to heavily indebted companies, heavily indebted borrowers. And I mention all of that in the chapter. The paper then explains the background to the loan markets. I spend some time explaining the historical development of the markets following their early origins. We're then looking at the key facilities. So we have the euro loans, the different types of other possible use and applications, multi-purpose and multi-currency facilities, term and revolving facilities, credit lines, asset and property finance, project finance, property finance, acquisition finance, subordinated term. In all of these areas, we're using the same core terms and conditions, the same core legal provisions. With regards to the loan structures, again, we can always consider this in terms of the core financials, then the core obligations, and then the defaults. The financials, as always, are the principal, the term, the interest, the drawdown, and then the repayment and prepayment. If we understand all of this, we'll understand how the whole facility works and operates in practice, although there's various options and adjustments that we can make in particular deals in practice, which are all subject to negotiation. In terms of the issuance procedure, I've summarized all of that in the paper again. We'll need to take an initial mandate letter. We'll have an exchange of fee quotes. We're then going to enter into the term sheet. The term sheet is a summary of the transaction that we're going to enter into. It's become, in practice, it was meant to be quite short, usually set out in the form of a telex, which could be exchanged, possibly a one-page telex, really emphasizing the financial terms, which could be very short. In practice now, it's almost a summary loan agreement. It's effectively the index to the loan agreement, and all of the key points will be dealt with. I will provide on the system a sample example. So in the term sheet, we'll summarize all of the financials, all of the key obligations, and all of the core default provisions with any other special terms and conditions to be included. We will prepare an information memorandum. This is essentially a background document to the borrower, to the borrower's condition, development, business use, business applications, what it intends to do with the funds and how it will repay the monies obtained. This is to allow the banks to undertake their own credit assessment. And each bank will specifically undertake its own original credit assessment, distinct from any other bank, and not rely on the other banks. And we have specific clauses to that effect in the document to confirm the several relationship and nature of the parties concerned. The information memorandum then allows them to make their credit assessment. That's to determine whether they want to lend, how much they want to lend, and what's the risk, and therefore at what cost, what's the interest. So it's those three things. Do we lend? How much do we lend? and what's the risk, so therefore what's the interest we expect. We'll agree the loan procedure in terms of negotiation. I've summarised all of that. It's very similar both in a loan deal and in a capital market deal, in a bond deal. There's just adjustments depending upon the nature of the specific types of additional facilities and operations that we have to consider, and all of the specific documentation that has to be drafted, executed, and then signed and exchanged there. Fees, there's three specific fees that we need to watch. You'll have what's called a commitment fee. It's paid by the borrower to each of the syndicate banks, to the syndicate as a whole, effectively to each of the banks, for making available the whole facility. So in our example, it's 100 million. So it will be a percentage or a part of a percentage of 100 million simply for making that available. The banks will also be paid interest during each drawdown, but they will receive a commitment period on top of that. Typically 0.5%, maybe a little lower if the borrowers can agree that. There's also going to be an arranging fee for the lead bank. It will be a percentage again of the total facility, possibly 0.5%, possibly more if it can. So it will receive a single fee based on the total facility. In practice, very often what will happen is the lead bank, the arranging bank, specialises in bringing these syndicates together, entering into the deals, but then moving on. It will want to appear to be a member of the syndicate to encourage other banks to come in, but it won't actually want to do the lending. So very often, this is very common in practice, the lead bank will actually bring in another bank to undertake its lending obligations, its lending commitment, even before the loan agreement's been signed. We call that a participation. If the borrower doesn't know, it's a blind participation. The arranging bank is focusing on the large fee, one-off fee that it will receive. It's not that interested in receiving the interest payments and the syndicate fee, which will be paid afterwards. We also then separately have an agent fee for the agent bank. This will be on almost an hourly or more administrative basis because its functions are non-executive and only of a sort of a business management arrangement, as we saw before, in terms of its notification duties, banking duties, receipt duties, and default duties. It carries out a much less significant role in terms of sort of design and originality, therefore the payments are correspondingly smaller, although this is still an essential function and role to ensure that the facility actually operates and works in practice. I then expand on the nature of the syndicate relationship. So we're looking at these ideas in further detail: severality, proportionality, equality, democracy, limited delegation of function. And then again, we can understand that in terms of the core responsibilities of the agent bank: receipt duties, payment duties, banking duties, and notification and default duties. I summarise the liability points, as I mentioned before. I then have a separate chapter, paper, which examines this in further detail. We then move on to the core sets of loan conditions and obligations which will apply in practice. There's three main sets of provisions: the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the covenants. One provisional point to make is that all of this and the negotiation which surrounds this will be expressed to be subject to contract. There is a legal presumption of intention to enter into legal obligations, so it is very easy for a court to construe a contract has been created. For that reason, we express all of the early documentation to be subject to contract, to reverse this presumption. That was Edwards Skyways, 1964, One Weekly Law Reports, 349. Even if all the contract terms haven't been agreed, including important terms which have been left for further negotiation, you can still have a contract. Branca versus Kubara, 1947, King's Bench, and the Anemone. This can also arise where non-essential terms have been left for future negotiation, Pagnam SPA versus Fee Products. So for all of these reasons, we always express this to be subject to contract so that we do not create legally enforceable obligations before we've concluded all of the negotiations and entered into the final formal duties that we expect. What we then need to consider is the nature of the obligations that we are going to agree, which will apply following the coming into effect of the loan documentation. It appears that the conditions precedent seem to be pre-agreement. The representations and warranties would be pre-drawdown under each facility within the agreement, and then the covenants are continuing afterwards. When we actually look at the content and use and application of these in practice, we will see that the conditions precedent apply on every drawdown. You cannot deliver a utilization request and draw down under the facility unless you've complied with the CPs, as well as any continuing precedents, as well as early conditions precedent, as well as any other evergreen provisions which may apply, although that term tends to be used more with regards to the representations and warranties. So what we can observe is that in practice, the representations and warranties are effectively pre-agreement. The conditions precedent pre-drawdown, and then the covenants apply on a continuing basis thereafter. What we will see is this. With regards to the CPs, these tend to be of more of a constitutional nature. They apply with regards to the main constitutional documents, as well as sovereign confirmation, securities, and legal opinions. But what we're trying to do in this case again is this. We're going to have the CPs, the reps and Ws, and the Cubs. Each of these has a different status in law. So for example, representations. A representation is a statement of fact rather than of opinion or law. That's Leaf versus International Galleries, 1950, All ER 693. A warranty is an undertaking or a promise to act in a certain way. So the representations and warranties are quite distinct. However, breach of both of those only creates damages. It doesn't allow rescission. And this is what the banks want. What we have to do is this. We want to try and elevate through the documentation drafting the representations and warranties together. So a representation has the same status as a warranty, but then both of those equal a condition. So that the remedy is then rescission rather than just simple damages. And I expand on all of this in the paper and in the footnotes. You will see that breach may give the borrower, similar to representation, we can have rescission, but we can have damages, but we still can't have rescission. Representations are not incorporated as terms of the contract directly. That's Oscar Chess versus Williams and Dick Bentley. Even if a term is a warranty, breach will only entitle the other party to damages and not rescission. So we're always going to try to elevate terms so that we create them as obligations and conditions rather than simply representations of warranties. In practice, what we'll also then do is this, we're going to connect those and tie those into the defaults directly, so that in the event of breach of any of this, we have full default. What I then do in the rest of the chapter is that I'm going to review the key terms and aspects of all of this. So in terms of conditions precedent, we have constitutional documentation, we have sovereign confirmations, security, legal opinions, confirmation or other evidence, and conditions subsequent. We will have legal opinions with regards to the effectiveness of the documentation in each of the countries where we're going to want to enforce this. So if there's parties which will be liable, or security in any specific jurisdiction, we will take legal opinions as to the effectiveness of that in each of those jurisdictions. We will possibly also then specify other conditions subsequent in addition to conditions precedent. As I've already explained, the conditions precedent are technically not precedent to the law agreement, to the loan agreement itself. They're conditions precedent to the drawdown under the loan agreement. Representations and warranties. We have legal warranties and we have financial warranties. What we will see is this. A number of obligations effectively come up in different ways. So with regards to the legal warranties and then the financial warranties, we'll undertake to provide documentation and then we'll represent that this is valid, and then we'll also have separate supporting covenants to undertake to stay within certain limits and ratios on a continuing basis thereafter. When you are reviewing the documentation, look for these connections, look for these relationships, look for these points. We then have the continuing covenants. The covenants consist of the corporate covenants. The most important include the negative pledge, the pari passu, and the disposals, as well as the financial covenants and then other information supply obligations. Negative pledge is an important provision. It basically determines and prevents the borrowers from granting further security, which may undermine the recovery of the banks in the particular case. We want this to be as wide as possible in terms of scope, so it will include all sorts of different types of obligations, as well as all forms of security and instruments of equivalent effect, such as sale and leasebacks, recourse financing, account charges, and preferential arrangements. All security will be covered, including, for example, mortgages, charges, liens, any type of security arrangement, collateral arrangement that we could create. It will apply to the borrower and all of the subsidiaries, and well as separately guarantors. The problem, however, is this: we don't want to undermine the daily operation of the companies, of the borrowers and the operations concerned. So therefore, we have to have another set of exclusions. So this will include, for example, disclosed or permitted security, and that will be provided for in one of the schedules to the document. So we've pre-disclosure of specific security, but also on a day-to-day basis, we'll have netting and set-off, we'll have general liens, we'll have security over after acquired companies, and other sort of more day-to-day provisions, including a more general, what we call de minimis. So there'll be a certain limit of, say, £5,000, $5,000, $10,000. Anything below that we will exclude as well. Because what we don't want to do is we do not wish the daily operations of the companies to create immediately a default, trigger a default, which then could also trigger possible cross-default in other facilities as well. So we're trying to be as wide, very often, and detailed as we can, but then we also have to incorporate an appropriate set of exclusions to ensure that this does not work inappropriately in practice. We've also got pari passu obligations, so that the ranking of this class of instruments, this entitlement, is equal to all other unsecured and subordinated obligations. And then we're also going to put limits on disposals, again, so that we do not undermine the asset base against which the banks can recover in practice. We'll then have separate information covenants which will support the financial covenants we've referred to already, and possible other general undertakings which will be specified in the documentation. All of this we're then going to tie into the default clauses. So obvious provisions will clearly include non-payment, breach of financial covenants, other non-financial breach, misrepresentation. So this comes up again. We need to watch this. So it's an express default as well as having alternative remedy under the common law and under the statutory provisions, including fraud under the Theft Act and or deceit, as well as misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. Very important clause is the cross default. What will happen is if there is a default under this facility, this can trigger default under other facilities. So we need to also ensure that if there's a default under other facilities, agreements that the borrowers have entered into, this will automatically trigger a default under this one. These cross default can cause substantial difficulty in practice, simply because if one is triggered, they're all triggered, and what can then happen is that you're looking at the immediate insolvency of the borrower and the borrower's group. Therefore, there's no ability to renegotiate, there's no ability to try and come up with alternative terms. It means basically failure, closure, and possibly loss of all income and all recovery. The cross defaults, we have to be careful then. We want them to be generous and provide a large amount of protection, but we don't want them to be too easily triggered that it can cause default under other facilities and then basically immediate, almost inevitable insolvency. We also then have standard insolvency clauses, creditor process clauses, loss of control clause, illegality clause, repudiation clause, and then again, very important, a material adverse change. Similar difficulties arise with regards to the MAC as occur with regards to the cross default. We want this to be as general, protective, supportive as possible, but if it's too wide, it's going to automatically trigger a default, and then that of itself could trigger the cross default in other documents. We have to be very careful how we draft these clauses, these provisions. We specifically need to consider to what extent the material adverse change is only going to be in the circumstances of or condition of the borrower itself or wider market circumstances, and under what terms there is going to be a default, and whether this is going to require prior notice or any other trigger action to be taken. I will provide sample MAC clauses on the system as well. If there is any form of default, we then have to consider the remedies. There's specific case law which arises in this area with regards to the defaults themselves, as well as to earlier rights and obligations in the event that, for example, the banks don't lend or the borrowers don't draw down, or to what extent there is commitments and when these arise, when these are triggered at specific times. I deal with that earlier in the paper. I also consider the more specific points which arise with regards to default here as well. In terms of the general remedies that apply in practice, we can consider this in terms of five core remedies: suspension of further drawdown, cancellation of further drawdown, cancellation of all obligations to lend, acceleration, and then we can have rescission of the documents, and then we can sue for damages. So we consider this in terms of a series of entitlements with suspension, cancellation outright of all obligation, and then rescission, as well as suing for damages separately. The additional case law that arises with regards to that I've explained in the paper. We're then looking at loan transfers. As we've already explained, loan obligations were essentially private and bilateral. It wasn't possible to transfer them at early stages, although we then subsequently developed various forms of legal and equitable assignment, as well as now novation, and then participation and sub-participation. We can only assign benefits. We can only transfer rights and entitlements. We cannot assign obligations. So if we want to transfer obligations, such as bringing in another bank to take on the lending commitments of the lead bank, the arranging bank, that has to be by novation. Novation is a form of substitution, whereby we terminate the first obligation and then enter into a substitute set of relationships under the novated terms. Assignment, as we've said already, is provided for under Section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925. It has to be in writing for an unconditional amount and with notice being provided. Otherwise, you have an equitable assignment. The difficulty there simply is that you can lose priorities if there's prior notice given in practice. In terms of the most common use, it will be by novation, because the banks are going to want to stand down and then bring in another party. There are, however, then additional provisions which are included and provided for in the loan documentation with regards to change of parties. So therefore, change of lenders is dealt with under Section 24 of the standard documentation that we're looking at. And then again, change of obligors is dealt with under Section 25. There's also participation is when you bring in a bank behind another bank. This can either be covered or uncovered, sort of disclosed or undisclosed. We call it a blind participation. Again, very often, this simply means that the party is undertaking your obligation, so this will be a form of novation. You can also have what we call a risk participation if there's any element of contingent liability. For example, it's like a guarantee, or it's something, there's an unconfirmed amount due yet, for example, under the letter of credit, and there's an obligation to provide that. We call that a risk participation because it's still contingent and it may arise in future. There's other forms of transfer referred to, such as securitization, such as trust, sometimes also agency and brokerage. Strictly speaking, these can create economically equivalent forms of transfers, although legally they don't actually transfer the rights and obligations themselves, which we do under the assignments, the novations, and the participation. The rest of the chapter then considers this issue of restructuring. As we've said already, the banks are generally always going to want to renegotiate. They want to protect their ability to recover their principal and also receive some return, even if it's not the original amount that was intended. Therefore, they will always be open to renegotiation. As I've said, there's two main clubs. There's the Paris Club and the London Club. If it's government to government, sovereign to sovereign, you renegotiate through the Paris Club in Paris. Generally, someone from the Ministry of Finance in Paris will chair the meetings. The London Club is then a little more informal. This is banks to sovereign, rather than sovereign to sovereign. Meetings can be held in New York or in other financial centres. There's also the heavily indebted provisions which are provided for by the IMF, dealing with countries which have got large amounts of debt and they simply haven't got the income to pay for them. There's ways of writing that off. What tends to happen is that from a negotiation perspective, sovereign debt and international financial institution debt, as we've mentioned before, they will usually agree to extend duration and reduce the interest payments, but they'll still want repayment of principal. Private banks will be more agreeable, amenable to terminating the principal payments as well, if they're still going to receive something. So they will accept, for example, 65%, 65 cents on the dollar, or 50% even if necessary, so they still recover something. All of the detail to this I have examined in the paper. All of this, again, is dealt with in the papers provided, including the diagrams, as well as all of the other linked documents. And with all of this, we can understand the nature, structure, and operation of the international loan and syndicated lending market.